You can go ahead and place your little biblical marker, your tag, your bookmark, wherever in Psalm 78. Take a second to do that. We're going to get there. We got a little bit of a ramp to climb before we get into that particular text this morning. But I think once we get there, it's going to be a really enriching and rewarding experience for all of us. I want you to think for a moment and try to come to an answer with this basic question. If someone came to you right now, no matter where your life seems to be this second, and asked you a question like, "What did your father teach you?" How difficult would that answer be to come to like a thing? I say that understanding that not all of us have really great relationships with our fathers. Some of our fathers were not in line with biblical teaching. Some of our fathers did not care much about God at all. Some of our fathers were very caring in regards to God's message and God's work. Some of us may not even have ever known, truly known, our own fathers. And so there's a lot of space between what did your father teach you and whatever answer we're going to come with. Because then we have to narrow our context. You say, now what are we talking about? Are we talking about all the things and stuff that makes up the extra parts of our lives? Is it about what cars are the best? Because I don't know if you noticed this, but in many cases, car brands go from generation to generation. Like people like what their dads like and their moms liked. It doesn't matter if the math underneath it adds up or the stats or the experiences, because we attach the emotion to the thing. So asking the question, what kind of car you liked, also might help us understand what did your dad teach you? Because he may have taught you to like a certain brand of car. Or their hobbies, their activities, their interests. The team that they rooted for, if they were into sports. The author that they read from the most, if they were literally inclined. Their favorite artists, whether it was music or media. Through osmosis, through direct instruction, through some mechanism, somebody was a mentor to you, a father or something else, that built within you a passion for any number of the things that make you, you. Biblically speaking, if we're going to go back and ask this question, what should a father teach us? We've shifted our context a little bit. We've actually made it harder in some ways because we've raised the bar because a father may not know what to teach. A father is, I think, easily recognized as someone who should be teaching their child about God. And in the 78th Psalm, which we're going to be reading from in a moment, we're not there yet, just foreshadowing. There's a segment of it that begins with that picture. And it's Father's Day, and I'm going to go ahead and steal that reality from the world around us. And ask the question, when the father rises, what do they tell their children? And dads, when you rise, what do you tell your children? And young ones, someday, mother or father, you will rise and you will tell somebody in your life about things that matter. Generationally, we hope that this creates an environment that is rich in spiritual substance. And it can go wide to the people around you. It can go deep to those behind or in front of you. But we hope that we rise and we tell the people we love about what God has done, will do, and is doing. Now I say all of that because in many ways, there's a couple of challenges that exist that we don't always process well. When we read our Bibles, we are actually often doing two things at the same time, even though we acknowledge maybe four or five additional ones on the side. We are reading the Scriptures, but we are reading the Scriptures as they exist in the communities of the people who live within them. Did you know that there's a big difference between the communities of the times of the Judges and the times of Jesus? There is. Remember this. Even though they served the same God under the same law, huge differences in those communities and the way they lived and where they lived. And often that impacts the way that the biblical message gets managed in the lives of the believers. And you and I, we live in neither of those times. We're in what we would consider an industrialized society. And how much of time has shifted in time spent with families? A few years ago, 10, 15, 20, I remember hearing more frequently the phrase, spending some quality time with my family. And all of us, by the way, I think love that quality time. Usually it's vacation. That's awesome. But I remember that there's also the value of quantity time. Even if it's quantity time spent doing nothing. Because those shared experiences are opportunities for you to catch it, rise and tell. We can't change the fact that we don't live in the first century, the 10th century BC, or the 10th century AD. We live where we live now, and we live in an industrialized world. What we have to do then is to make sure we manage it in a godly fashion and take advantage of the shifts that are around us to greater spiritual profit. Because it's evident, biblically and practically, that there is an obligation, a command, that we teach the generations underneath us about God and the generations next to us to be faithful to Him and the generations above us to keep that commitment. All of that is still true. All right then, that's the lead up. So now we're at Psalm 78. That's our backdrop, that's our context for thinking about the idea of rising and telling that fathers should be doing, that you and I can do even though we may not be fathers ourselves. Especially if we're interacting with people who aren't our own children. And in the text, in the Scriptures, in the psalm, by means of poetry, prose, and actual instruction, there are tools for us to accomplish this goal. And by the way, we're not going to read the entire psalm together today. You get to do that this afternoon if you'd like. But we are going to read at least the first 8 verses and talk about the rest. So we're going to get in there. So let's start with verses 1 through 8 of Psalm 78. Read it together. And then we'll back up and think about what the psalmist Asaph is doing for us. Psalm 78 verse 1 begins, "Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings from of old. Things that we have heard and known that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from our children, but tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and His might, and the wonders that He has done. He established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which He commanded our fathers to teach to their children, that the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn, and arise and tell them to their children, so they should set their hope in God, and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments, and that they should not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation whose heart was not steadfast, whose spirit was not faithful to God. All right, I don't know if you caught some of the quick connections that God is giving us through the psalm, this maskil of Asaph, but here's some quick highlights before we actually break down the text. Did you notice things of familiarity, like the statement, "I'm going to tell you a parable"? That's a very Jesus-like teaching tool, so you can remember that. Did you notice how far the expectation was for this work to go? It's not for just those who are living, but it's for those who have not even yet been born. To the unborn, this matters. And what matters? What matters is what Paul would write to the brethren in Rome, that from the old scriptures, the Old Testament, from the writings, they would learn, get understanding so that they might have hope. So the goal of the maskil, the goal of the psalm, is that these children not yet born would have hope, and hope particularly in God. And then you may also recognize in verses 7 and 8 that this statement that makes its appearance a couple other times in the teachings of Jesus, they would not be stubborn, rebellious, that they would not be without heart, instead that they would be steadfast. And that last little clause at the end of verse 8 is so much alike to what Jesus says in the Gospel of John and in other places, that we worship God with spirit and truth. You have some biblical tie-ins to help you draw yourself into the passage, which is in many ways teaching us about the future. There are actually three breakouts in this psalm as put together by Asaph in this maskil for us: future, past, and present. And we're going to get through those in order. So let's take a moment, look deep into this text, and think about the future from the eyes of this one psalmist. You and I would not be in the place that we are in right now if it were not for the trustworthy and faithful behavior of disciples of God who knew nothing of Jesus to engage in the spiritual activity of both preserving the scriptures but seeking to be zealous practitioners of the word. Until the Christian Bible, the New Testament, is presented in the closing sections of the first century, this is our Bible. These are the stories that were shared. The Bible of the early church is the Old Testament. The hymnal of the early church are the Psalms. And the advice sections and the exhortation that they would come and put together would go hand in hand with inspiration. And so men would speak directed by God and read both from passages like this and other sections of the Hebrew Bible to grow faith. And it was only God's law that each generation was commanded really to hand down. They could leave their culture behind, and they should, because culture changes. But standard of faith didn't. And by the way, the Psalms, there's a ton of Psalms that are written kind of in the same attempt or genre, which is like a history psalm, where it gives you a history lesson with a little bit of a poetic feel to it. So this one, Psalm 78, but 105, 106, 114, 135, 136, they all do the same basic thing, where they use history to teach about the past, present, and future. The order changes a little bit at times. And there's a phrase you may have heard before that I think will help us think about the future in this way. The only thing that we tend to learn from history, and we get the quote just right from Hegel, he's a German philosopher. He writes this way, that the only thing that we tend to learn from history is that we don't learn from history. There's tons of lessons in history, but we just never learn them. For all kinds of reasons. And we can go into that at a different time. So again, thinking about verses 1 to 8 and the future. What he does here in this opening refrain is shrink down the reality of their experiences that go from their freedom from Egypt to the promised land of Israel, with the highlight underneath all of this that things won't always be easy. And he's telling the current generation to be ready to tell the generation that's coming, prepare for the future, because it may not be like it is today. And so that's his big selling introduction. And he does it in a way that's similar to the Proverbs, to Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. You'll notice in verse 1, listen up, my people. Give me your ear. Are you paying attention? I like the Proverbs, incline your mouth to the words. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. Really is doing many of the same things that Jesus also would do and John would do in the New Testament with their introductions to their sermons. That then leads to his next step. Here's the future. The future's coming. What do I do? What's the practical thing? So the next step for him, since he's talking about the future, is to talk about the past. And he does it in a way that's a little bit different. The effort of Asaph here is not facts and figures, dates and numbers. It's not a list of events. It's a series of explanations so that they can understand the past. That's really hard to do, right? Because let me ask you this question. This is rhetorical. Do you understand your own past? Do you understand what happened to you from ages 0 to the first 10 years of your life? Let me reframe that for some of us. Do you remember what happened to you from age 0 to age 10? Some. Like, my memory starts showing up around age 5 or 6 in clumps. But if you ask me what happened on a certain day when I was in second grade, I'd be like, I got nothing. Something happened. I went to school probably. Probably got in trouble. Probably got sent to the principal's office. Sent back to the teachers. You know, I tell it on myself, but that was probably a likely outcome. I was probably bored, to be fair. I can tell you that, but that isn't the same as understanding my past. Or do you understand your past in light of the why your parents made various decisions for you? Or do you understand or remember why you made certain decisions for your children? Because in some ways, that's what he's doing here. We put it in context with Father's Day this way, so it's accessible for us. Because he's going to cycle through failure with an eye towards hope. Because that's part of this goal. So in verses 19 and 11... the first table item is the apostasy of Ephraim. The passage here refers to the northern kingdom of Israel when the 10 tribes broke away from Judah and Benjamin. They eventually adopted the name of their strongest tribe, Ephraim, and goes through the cycle that made them like they were. If you were to rewind the clock and say, if there was a decision we could undo as Israel that would be for our own good, this would be one of them. The fracturing of the kingdom leads to apostasy in great numbers here. And it was bad. Like, it wasn't just a little bad. It's really bad. Awful. So his first lesson from the past, to bring from the past to the future generations, is to remember this. Remember Ephraim. Secondly, in this section that began in verse 9, is verses 12 to 39, and it's talk about the time in the wilderness. You think about God birthing the people of Israel from Egypt, pulling them out, passing through the water. It's a birth picture. And the child that is born is stubborn and rebellious. He brings them by power and providence to a land that he says is prepared for them, that their spies say is full of milk and honey. The reports come back. They bring, pictured in the text for us, grapevines that are mammoth and abundant. Now, we live in a very green space. And so I want you to think about it this way. Don't just take your mind and say, I'm living in the desert now and someone brought me a big plant. There is an invasive species of plant in Georgia that most of us despise called kudzu, right? And kudzu just grows and grows and grows. This will be easy for you. Imagine if kudzu was your favorite food and you lived in a place that didn't have it. And you came to Georgia and you saw a kudzu field. Oh, look at all that. Now, I don't know if kudzu tastes good. I'm pretty sure it doesn't. So don't go test that theory. But that's the picture to think about. When they come to a place like the land that God has prepared for them, the spies come back with this amazing thing. And their response from day one till they bounce off the promised land and have to get back into the wilderness with a second round is to reject all God's care for them. I've given you manna. I've given you water. I'm so tired of manna. No more of that, please. Anything but manna. Oh, you mean that too? A quail. Oh, I'm so tired of quail. We all get the same way. And yet, that was just the start of their rebellion. And by the way, that becomes the framework for the latter comments in verses 7 and 8 about their stubbornness and their rebellion. Then it moves from the wilderness back further in history to lessons from Egypt. So pause for a moment and think about the power of God demonstrated to them in their birthing. The plagues, the care, the protection. Charles Spurgeon, I think, said it best, describing particularly the Israelites' experience with Egypt and our own when God blesses us. He says that we are far too prone to engrave our trials in marble and write our blessings in sand. Because which one endures? And which one should endure? So the next section of the past for them to grapple with and to tell the future generations is to think about the blessings that God had granted them. Even though we sometimes make lip service to them. Further, the last part of the history portion, the past if you will, is a reminder of the rebellion once they got to the promised land, Canaan itself. God's care for them, His intention, His plans is being resolved before their eyes, and yet in the end, they make halfway truces with the people around them. They fail to fully complete the mission beforehand and have to continually be spurred along. And it wasn't really even until the time of David that the power of Israel got beyond Canaan. Or more specifically, got outside of the cities they captured when the armies arrived. For the land itself became part of the kingdom. And all of that, it sets the stage for the last phase, to think about the now. Verse 65 in our psalm reads this way. Then the Lord awoke as from sleep, like a strong man shouting because of wine. And the Psalms always kill it with their verbal word plays and their imagery. You may not know exactly what's going on there. You might not have a personal connection to it. But all of us can begin to picture the startled nature of a person awoken from a deep slumber. That's a picture there. You just think about someone who was sleeping really deeply, and you were the person chosen to go wake him up. Oh, and by the way, the person that is really sleeping deeply is not really meek and like tiny. They're mammoth. That's the image here. Like you're like, I'm going to use a little 10-foot pole and kind of poke him from a distance because I don't want to wake the bear. The image here that shifts from a reminder that you're looking to the future, you're going to teach the past, is to pay attention to the present. And the image that shifts our view is one of the Lord waking from his slumber. It continues, verse 66. And he put his adversaries to rout. He put them to everlasting shame. He rejected the tent of Joseph. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but he chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loves. He built his sanctuary like the high heavens, like the earth, which he has founded forever. He chose David, his servant. He took him from the sheepfolds, and following the nursing ewes, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, Israel, his inheritance. With upright heart, he shepherded them and guided them with his skillful hand. The contextual picture is thinking about David and Solomon as the eventual king shepherds of Israel and God's hand in making that possible. You and I are in much the same space. We have a shepherd hand picked by God. Amazing in his capacity to both provide and understand. God tells us that part of the developmental process for Jesus' experience on earth was to benefit us. So that when he serves as a mediator, he shows that he understands us. And so the illustration in the text of God's selection of David, Solomon, for Israel's perspective, can now be folded to us too. Because they should appreciate the present that God has built for them and not forget the past and turn this message to the future. But let's make the quick application. If these kings were called shepherds, and they were, because God's chosen people were the sheep of his pasture, that's you and I. We are God's chosen people, the sheep of God's pasture. And when Psalm 23 echoes in our minds, and we talk about the grand shepherd that is Christ shepherding our souls, remember the full totality of what that means for us. And think about just one blessing that the Heavenly Father has taught you. As we started with what our fathers may have taught us or should have taught us. But the psalm tells us, in principle, to start thinking about the blessings that God has granted us and taught us. And find one blessing today, and then do one more thing. Write it in stone, in marble. Engrave it in some way in your life that it will not trickle away through tomorrow. Because I don't know what the future holds. But I do know that if our life mimics God's Son, and it does, then at some point you're going to need a rock. And sand won't help you. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the blessing of assembly to get together today. We thank you for your Son who is our rock. Help us that our faith is built on him and not on culture, not on today's new ideas or yesterday's failed ones, but simply on the testimony of your Son, the evidence of his resurrection, and the heaven that is prepared for us. Help us to build a faith that is living and active, that not only waits patiently for your plan, but acts out of commitment to you, to the service of the kingdom and to others. Help us learn to be instructors and educators, to share the lessons of the past toward the future that we will never see, as we await the heaven that is promised for all. Help us appreciate our blessings. Help our faith to grow. This is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen.